Kids, as you might have noticed, say some really awful things to one another. Things I heard when I was a kid are things like, are you a boy or a girl? Politicians in our time stop just short of saying that very phrase, but there's a political fascination with the needs and desires of people who start at one gender and move to another, or simply choose not to be identified by gender. We'll focus less on the political and more on the medical as we explore a book by Steph M. Schuster called Trans Medicine, The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender. The book details the history and current issues with trans people obtaining quality medical care from a system that often doesn't understand their needs. Steph M. Schuster is an assistant professor of sociology at Michigan State University. Steph prefers they/them pronouns and their name spelled with lowercase letters. Steph, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You would seem to be uniquely qualified to explore this subject, not just because it is your field of study, sociology, but also because it is your life, and you share that with us in the book. Talk about seeking health care when you entered your PhD program at the University of Iowa.
Yeah, moving to a new town is always challenging, I think, for a lot of people and finding healthcare providers in general. When I moved to Iowa City in 2007 to start my PhD program, I looked around, I asked around, and no one could direct me to any medical providers who were familiar enough in working in trans medicine. And so for me, as a trans and non-binary person, that kind of led to a lot of healthcare advocacy, training providers, and just listening to the kinds of questions they had about how to best meet the needs of trans patients. And then that sort of kicked off my, my dissertation work.
So, it sounds like you had to jump through some hoops just to even find an MD, let alone find one who would treat you.
Yeah, so I think there is this really interesting distinction that we can think about between, you know, a provider who's willing to work with someone and a provider who wants to work with someone. And it can really change what it feels like in a healthcare encounter. So I was able to find a few providers who were willing to and eventually found and started working with providers who, who wanted to work with trans people and wanted to increase their knowledge and just learn how to do it, not only from, you know, a gender-affirming medicine, but also general healthcare needs.
Mm-hmm. So, and I did a little extra research outside just to see, apparently by some recent counts, maybe 0.6% of the population identifies as trans. So that's a lot of population that doesn't really understand to start with. And so I guess what I'm asking is an identification of how broad the spectrum is for trans and non-binary people, the kinds of treatments sought. It seems like there'd be a lot of different case-by-case choices.
Yeah, there are. And I think that that's where it gets really complicated for medical providers, right? So providers are kind of trained to think about the delivery of healthcare from a standardized perspective, so that, you know, regardless of who you are, if you come in with a certain set of symptoms, you more or less will get the same kind of treatment, right? And we can certainly talk about later, I think, how bias plays into that and also different, like, shapes healthcare encounters differently. But one of the main challenges in trans medicine is that if you go out and ask 100 trans and non-binary people how they understand their identities, why they're seeking healthcare, what they are trying to get out of gender-affirming care, you might get 100 different answers. And that makes it challenging for providers as well.
So in the early 2000s, was the confusion from providers over that range, or was it just overall ignorance of the fact that there are trans people?
I think it was a little of both. Yep. So, if we go back to the early 2000s, there's not a lot of people at that time identifying as non-binary. And when I use that term, I mean people whose gender is not identified within a woman or a man, but something beyond those categories. And so, you know, in any kind of new medicine, there's always going to be a lot of uncertainty for providers. But in trans medicine, early 2000s, it's both providers are just trying to figure out, you know, like what, how do I understand this patient before me who identifies as trans? And what does that mean and what does that look like in this kind of health decision making?
And so, over the last 15 years or so, do you see that the situation has improved at all?
I think it has changed. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's just collectively in our society, more people are familiar and aware with the fact that trans people exist. I think that medical providers are even incrementally being exposed to more formal training and education when they go through residency programs. But there's still a lot. There's still a lot of ground that needs to be covered that they're not always exposed to in formal training.
When we're just talking about healthcare providers here, I have to wonder how insurance companies handle this. Have they evolved much themselves over the last 15 or 20 years?
Well, I'm sure as a lot of people have experienced firsthand, the health insurance landscape in the U.S. is quite fractured. It depends, you know, your coverage might depend on what state you live in, where you're employed, and even within that, there's several different options sometimes that exist for insurance coverage. I will say that over the last 10 to 15 years, insurance companies have been more open to offering gender-affirming care, but it is a delicate negotiation, and sometimes they fall back on older ways of thinking about trans people and creating all of these different hoops that trans people have to jump through before they can get some of their needs met and covered by insurance.
Older ways of thinking about trans people, does that mean basically moving from one pole to another with no stop in the middle?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a very, restrictive set of steps. So first you have to go to, a primary care provider, and then you go to a therapist and have therapy for, up to 6 months. And then they recommend that you can start gender affirming care. And then you go back to the physician. That way of thinking, that model of care began in the 1950s and up until maybe the last decade was kind of the main model that people understood that trans people should go through before they could access medicine. Insurance companies kind of follow that model, even though it's been revised in the last decade.
Steph, I have to wonder, as a trans person, does the discussion frequently degrade into a variation of what genitalia do you have?
It depends on the situation. In certain health encounters, I've experienced that less over time. I think in the beginning, back in the early 2000s, that definitely was the, what parts do you have? Which it could have been for something like I came in for bronchitis and they want to talk about genitals. So I think we've kind of moved beyond that, exoticizing of trans people's bodies. And at least in a lot of parts of the country. I think doctors are a little bit more familiar now with that those are kind of insulting and inappropriate questions. So.
If you would, give the overview of the book, what you covered and over what time period. I've been talking about a history lesson, but you can give a better setup than I can.
Oh, yeah, sure. So I began in the 1950s because that's really, trans medicine existed, closer to the early 1900s, but the 1950s is really when it takes off. So part one of the book is looking at how did medical providers think about trans people? How did they come up with treatment plans? What kind of evidence did they use in this new area of medicine? And how did they begin to identify what they perceived as, ideal candidates for being able to access gender-affirming care? You have to remember that during that time period, it was a doctor knows best model of care. And so if you were a patient, especially a patient in a new area of medicine, compliance with medical authority was the way to get through the door. From the 1970s, I kind of hop over a couple of incredibly important decades in U.S. medicine and then take us into contemporary medicine. So I think through how do those historical contexts, those ways of thinking about trans people and how to offer care, what's similar and what has changed, and what are the uncertainties that medical providers continue to grapple with as they try to work in trans medicine.
Well, and there's a really interesting statement you make right up front, a really mind-blowing concept in which you say that medicine is not just science. So what intersects with it and influences it?
Yeah, so, especially as I was working I went to the Kinsey Institute archives, which is located on Indiana University's campus. And I was looking at these archives and I was thinking about who are these so-called worthy patients or the patients that providers wanted to work with. They were patients who typically were white, they were middle class, they held, respectable jobs, they were willing to leave their families, start life anew as trans people. And that kind of lens through which we can understand trans people, or I guess medical providers understood trans people, is not about science. That's actually about social norms and values, about what a trans person was expected to look like and sound like in the 1950s. But while it sounds a little different now, there still are norms and assumptions that shape what providers are looking for in feeling certain in working with trans people.
Well, so the values then that come into the conversation mm-hmm. for medical providers, I mean, are the values trained in? Are efforts made to train them out in medical school?
I think there's a little bit more effort now to help providers recognize their own implicit biases so that prejudice does not seep into the medical encounter. But, you know, a number that you offered earlier was that we're talking about maybe 0.6% of the total population identifies as trans. That means that, trans people still represent a group that a lot of people have not interacted with personally. And from a sociological perspective, the more that we lack familiarity with a group, the easier it is for bias to come into those interactions. So I would say that, yes, absolutely, providers are being explicitly trained to recognize bias. Right now, there's lots of conversations going on about, you know, how to train doctors to not be racist and sexist and classist. But because trans medicine is still kind of this offbeat topic in the broader medical community, I think that they're not getting the kind of training that they could get. And that means that there's still bias that's playing out.
Steph M. Schuster is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Steph's book is Trans Medicine, The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender. So it's not just that medicine is making an attempt to change, but patient relationships with medical providers have really changed. I mean, from the patient end, now that people have researched the daylights out of whatever their concerns are and bring these to the doctor, is the industry yielding? And for that matter, Steph, yielding as much as you think it should?
Yeah, so, I mean, we definitely have seen, you know, pretty significant shifts over the last 70 years, where before, again, it was that doctor knows best model, patient compliance was mandated. So if you didn't follow a doctor's orders, you could be, you know, kicked out of that clinic and asked to not come back. I think now with the expansion of healthcare, and it's just a more complex healthcare system, that patients absolutely have more power. If they go to a doctor who says, you know, I'm not interested in working with you, or I don't know anything about trans medicine, patients do have a little bit more agency to go seek care elsewhere. I think where it gets complicated, though, is especially for people who live in rural areas, there might be one or two medical providers in general who work with the entire community.
Wow. So there's an effort, as you point out, to go with evidence-based medicine, just get to what works and how it has worked. Has much more evidence been coming in recent years? I mean, has there been a lot of expertise gained in treating trans people?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question with a complicated answer. So, you know, it's very difficult to run clinical trials on medical treatments for such a small population, right? You can't take 100 people and expose half of them to testosterone and the other half a placebo and see what the effects are, and hope that that also works with trans people. So on the clinical side, there's not, and I want to be very cautious because this is an argument that is being used currently in our political landscape, right? There is not a lot of clinical evidence on the long-term health risks of being on hormones. Mm-hmm. But there is a massive amount of evidence that just keeps accumulating about the psychological benefits of enabling trans people to access hormone therapy. So that's why I say it's a little complicated, right? There's not a lot of clinical data, but there is a lot of data on the psychological benefits and on one's well-being and being able to access trans care.
All right, so if you narrowly define on the body risks, there's not a lot known, but the broadly defined well-being, there is a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So.
So when you get to a couple of phrases in here that blew my mind, one of them is medical authority over gender. It's wow. I mean, it really is kind of a doctor or a group of doctors in a position to say, hey, you're this or you're that. But we're talking about a time when people maybe started as this, want to become that, or they want to be on a continuum. And I wonder if society at large is grasping this concept yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so if we think about from the 1950s through the early 2000s, even though there are still, you know, just some providers who are willing to work with trans people, they kind of established a particular way of thinking about trans people as those who seek to transition from woman to man or man to woman. And then come non-binary people who kind of blow up those assumptions. And, you know, in some ways, non-binary people are asking medical providers to reimagine how they understand trans care. That's not necessarily a comfortable position for providers to be in, right? And I think that on a social level, there's more people who are aware of trans women and trans men, and I think we're just now really starting to understand and talk about that there are also non-binary people. But I think that non-binary identities still present some challenges for people who are so used to thinking about gender equals women and men.
Well, it sounds like the expectation here is that medicine should be somewhat ahead of society, that certainly there should be science here, and more science, less value, I guess, or values.
Yeah. Although, you know, I guess if there's anything that we can say about the medical establishment, there are moments that we can see evidence that they can move quickly, such as response to COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And we can also see evidence that they're not so keen to move quickly. Trans medicine is a field that has been accumulating knowledge and more providers for 70 years. And yet there are still so many providers who don't really know much of anything about trans medicine. So, yeah, I think that also, you know, it becomes complicated in trying to pinpoint how quickly medicine can move and also maybe what their incentives are.
Steph M. Schuster is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor of sociology at Michigan State University and the author of Trans Medicine, The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender. We've been talking about the general value overlay. We're going to get into the history section here in just a moment. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I had a feeling this would come to a famous case at some point, and there's Christine Jorgensen. Right on schedule as we get into the history lesson. Christine was quite the trendsetter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She was. She absolutely was. So Christine, you know, is someone who established international notoriety in the 1950s as the media especially were just fascinated by, you know, how this person who was, in the army would want to change their gender. And she really represents, you know, one of the first well-known cases of, at the time, the language that was used was transsexual. I think, though, that where her story presents challenges in the 1950s is that she became, in some ways, the model case, right? So if you look at photos of Christine and you listen to her stories about how she identified as a trans woman, how she came to that knowledge about herself, she represents all of those markers that I was talking about before, right? She was hyper-feminine, middle class, had a respectable job, and was able to conform to these really rigid standards that were placed on women. And so for people who maybe couldn't quite fit into that, sometimes they were denied care because they didn't fit that ideal patient. It was almost like a trope, right? A trope of like the trans patient.
Yeah, and I'm looking actually at the Life magazine story, XGI becomes blonde beauty. I'd never even thought of it in those terms before, but in a way it had to be a kind of a celebrity thing for it to be able to happen, and not everybody's a celebrity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, Christine, I honor how important she was to the history of trans people and trans medicine, but because of the way that she appeared, it also created these, you know, really difficult gender expectations for a lot of trans people to meet.
And so, and by the middle of the 20th century, then, I mean, what did the medical and psych establishment make not of of the people seeking treatment, but of providers willing to treat?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, just as people were concerned that trans people were delusional, that, you know, that being trans or identifying as trans or seeking gender-affirming care was a symptom of schizophrenia, is what they thought at one point. So, too, the broader medical establishment thought that maybe their colleagues who were willing to work with trans people were also delusional, right? This was a moment when trans medicine was not widely embraced by the medical community. There were competing ideas about whether or not trans people should seek out therapists to change their perspective and to, you know, not be trans. And so there was a lot of controversy and a lot of concerns by the broader medical establishment that this kind of medicine was way too experimental and fraught. And so sometimes they stigmatize their colleagues who were willing to work with trans people.
You mentioned that even today there's some question about use of hormones in therapy. So I'm just wondering, back in the mid-50s and the 60s, whenever it was, I mean, mid-century, how did providers make decisions on things like hormone levels, given the serious lack of clinical history?
Oof, yeah. So if you look at the amount of hormones they were suggesting as like the recommended dose for trans people, I mean, it's just off the charts. And that does bring health risks, right? Like, we know that. We know that high levels of estrogen, whether someone is cisgender or transgender, can also lead to, you know, developing heart disease, you know, like all these things. So the amount of hormones that trans people were on 70 years ago, is where we are right now is about a fourth of the dose that was offered back then.
Okay. That makes a difference, yeah. You also bring up in this portion of the book the trans trickster trope. What was that?
Yeah, so again, we have to remember in the 50s and 60s that medical providers, like, they wanted to know with absolute certainty that someone who showed up in their clinic and said that they were trans were really who they said they were. And so there's this trope that develops in the 50s and 60s that trans people are, you know, these devious, mischievous people who are trying to trick medical providers into giving them hormones or letting them have surgery. and so there's all of these accounts in the archives of medical providers writing to each other as they're still trying to figure out what to do. And the language they use to describe trans people is, you know, a lot of them had kind of negative perspectives of trans people, even if they were willing to work with them, and thought that trans people were willing to lie at all costs in order to access hormone therapy. So,
I realize as we talk, Steph, that there is a contemporary parallel for the trans trickster trope in medicine, which is the idea that some people would claim to be trans just because they want to go in the girls' bathroom or locker room.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, you know, that kind of trope is a little bit more in, you know, like the trans person is a predator. But I'm using all air quotes. I know people can't see that.
But, but I appreciate the reference.
but you're right. I guess I hadn't really thought about it, but you're right. There are some similarities between the trans trickster in the 1950s who's, you know, who will say anything and do anything in order to access gender-affirming care. And right now, we do have this idea that, you know, people are willing to lie about themselves and say that they're trans in order to access, you know, gender segregated facilities such as bathrooms or locker rooms. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, did in the mid century, the first part of the book you're talking about here, in the history lesson part, did medicine and psychology essentially split into camps over treatment and proper treatment?
It goes back and forth. So at one point, providers were like, we need to figure out some way to mitigate our own risk and liability. And we need other professionals who have, hopefully, the tools and training to psychologically assess these patients. And so they invited therapists into trans medicine. And almost as soon as they did, they were like, uh-oh, we actually want to hold all the power and authority. And so you see these real tussles between psychiatrists and psychologists, between therapists and physicians, as each are trying to define trans medicine and who gets the ultimate say over whether or not a trans person can begin gender-affirming care.
I want to ask one final question about the history portion of the book, Steph, which is about sexual practices and how medical and psychology pros tended to view those in evaluating patients.
Yeah, so this is where, you know, trans medicine, you know, like often we talk, I think there's this tendency to think of trans medicine as so different that it's kind of disconnected from other areas of medicine. But the way that medical providers were just really concerned about the sexual identities, practices, and behaviors of their trans patients is actually really similar to the way that the medical establishment has also been concerned about cisgender women's sexuality and behavior and practices. And so, you know, the medical establishment not only wanted to document and categorize what kind of sex trans people were having, but also they wanted to ensure that if, when trans people transitioned, that their relational partners would put them into heterosexual relationships. And so they were very concerned about, you know, if someone transitioned and if someone identified as a trans woman, that after medical care, she would only take up relationships with men so that she could fall into, you know, respectable society. They also were really, especially psychologists, were just fascinated with, you know, things like masturbation. And it makes intuitive sense if you just think about it for a second that at that time, the medical establishment thought that one clear so-called symptom of being trans was that someone was just absolutely disgusted with their genitals. And so trans people who reported engaging in masturbation it was like a red flag for the medical establishment, because if you hated your genitals so much, then you wouldn't derive pleasure from them. And so there's just all of this correspondence and, you know, documentation from the medical and scientific communities about the sexual identities and behaviors of trans people. It just reminds me a lot of, like, you know, how women's sexuality has also been regulated by the scientific community.
It's a lot of judgment calls. I mean, a lot of like, well, you know, why would we do this if you're going to do that? I mean, why would we make you a woman if you're going to be a lesbian now? That is basically what it gets down to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right on point. So,
All right. So part two of the book gets into contemporary trans healthcare. And you mentioned that there's a transgender health summit. How long have things like that been going on?
The trans healthcare conferences?
Yes.
I believe they started in the early 2000s, maybe the late 90s, in response to such a lack of familiarity by the medical establishment. And, it's a professional organization. It's called the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH, that has been a formal organization for, I think, the last 30, 40 years. And so they started hosting, you know, weekend-long conferences to really try to reach other medical providers, whether they were gynecologists, family care providers, to increase their knowledge about how to work with trans people. And since then, there's more conferences that have kind of become annual across the country, mostly though on the coast.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned the Endocrine Society, and I just wonder if Endocrine Society tends to line up with WPATH, or does it take a different approach?
Yeah, so just like in the historical record of all those tussles between, you know, psychologists and physicians, there's also a little bit of some of that happening between the Endocrine Society and WPATH. WPATH tends to be populated a little bit more with psychologists and physicians, like family care physicians. The Endocrine Society is populated more with, well, of course, endocrinologists, but also psychiatrists. So even between those two organizations, there's kind of these, you know, legitimacy wars over whose knowledge, whose medical treatment plans are the most up-to-date.
All right. So obviously psychologists, psychiatrists still involved in this process. What is the current state of affairs? I mean, you mentioned that previously, if you even requested any information about changing gender, that you were sent to a therapist first. Does that still happen?
Yeah. So it's now a recommendation and not a requirement. I think that therapists pushed back because if you think about it, it really conflicts with the role of a therapist in working with a patient. And, a lot of the therapists that I spoke with when I interviewed them said, it's just not in my training to tell people what to do with their lives. Like that, it's antithetical to being a therapist. And so I think that therapists have been able to make inroads into changing that conversation to kind of cultivate more of a positive relationship, with their patients so that they're not placed in the role of a gatekeeper. Like that they are a hoop that trans people have to jump through in order to access gender-affirming care.
So where do things like the American Psychological Association, the APA, and the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the famous DSM, where do they stand currently? Do they still speak of things like gender dysphoria or abnormality in the terms that you used to use?
Yeah, so they've definitely switched their language. I think where it gets confusing for people is that the diagnostic category for working with trans people is gender dysphoria, and it shows up in the DSM, which is, what psychologists and psychiatrists use. And so it sort of symbolically conveys to people that being trans is somehow like a mental illness. There's been a lot of debate over that, but I think that if you look up, the diagnostic category for gender dysphoria, it makes sense why it shows up in a psychological code book. But there's still, I think that where it gets really tricky is that there's not a biological marker to, being trans. Like you can't run a blood lab and say, yes, you have a trans, it sounds silly, right? Like you have transgenderism. So I think it's a workaround the medical establishment has found to keep it in the DSM. But where trans people get concerned is that it might convey to people that being trans is a psychological illness and therefore should be treated with therapy alone rather than with hormones and sometimes surgery.
All right. So not officially an aberration as such anymore, but still something that is referenced in the DSM as potentially a source of confusion for some people.
Yeah, I mean, the DSM, so the latest version, version 5, I think really the APA, or the American Psychiatric Association, really tried to shift away from thinking about all mental illness or anything that falls within that manual as something that is a problem with the individual, right? And they really try to shift it more towards almost like a disability rights perspective that there's enough things in our social environment that create distress for people, especially like for gender dysphoria, right? So it's not on the individual, but rather socially there can be difficulties that trans people experience as they move through their lives. And that's what causes distress, not being trans itself.
So when you move beyond the psychological stuff and get back to the nub of what we're talking about here, the actual practice of medicine on trans people, I mean, it would seem to be a major step forward that there are diagnostic codes now. I mean, do they cover all of the potential procedures and guide both the healthcare providers and insurers a little better?
They do. For any medical treatment that one receives, if you want it covered by insurance, it has to have a diagnostic code attached to it. I think, though, that where there's still some conflict in the DSM is there's also another association, and it's called the World Health Organization, right? They have their own classification system, their own diagnostic codes, and there's conflict between how gender dysphoria shows up across those two organizations as well. But I do know that there's some providers I interviewed who talked about, one of the ways that they kind of worked around not wanting to communicate that their trans patients were mentally ill is they would use a completely different code, which was endocrine disorder not otherwise specified. It's a pretty vague, abstract code, and it still got the job done in getting insurance companies to cover care. So.
Wow, okay. Endocrine disorder not otherwise specified. All right. So let's talk about then, if you got diagnostic codes and obviously some fudge room there for use of the codes, are there any certifications or professional stamps of approval for providers who want to make sure that they are not only treating trans people in healthcare properly, but also want to get known for it?
So there are movements. I think they're a little bit more localized movements in cities, and through some of these healthcare conferences where, you know, so a lot of the healthcare conferences, for example, will offer continuing education credits. So there is an incentive for providers to show up and keep growing their knowledge. But as far as like certificates, I think that that's where we're headed. But I think that there are some concerns about moving in that direction. It's how a lot of specialties become established. And I already know some people are thinking, like, wait a second, but specialization is good because it means that you are, you know, you have expert knowledge and skills. So if you have, you know, cancer, for example, you go to an oncologist. Why should we not have specialization in trans medicine? My concern is that it silos trans people into a specialty track, and it allows all other providers to be absolved of responsibility for working with trans people outside of the gender-affirming care, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, trans people break their bones, and trans people get pink eye, and trans people get pregnant, and I worry that with a move towards hyper-specialization, that trans people's other healthcare needs are not going to be met.
Oh, that is an interesting line to try to straddle, the idea that on one side you want people to be better at treating people, but you also want them to be better at treating all people. And mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So just in general, though, is there greater acceptance in healthcare of the fact that there are trans people who have needs? And yes, as you point out, that, you know, they break bones, they get sick, they have bronchitis. It was the example you used before, and that has really nothing to do with their transness. Are people attending the trainings and seminars more, or are there still some people in healthcare who wouldn't get caught dead treating a trans person?
Yeah, so I think unfortunately there are some holdovers, people who maybe have moral objections. I'm not really sure what they're objecting to, but you know, there are some people who might also have a pretty strong bias and a belief system that there are two and only two genders, and that includes cisgender women and cisgender men. There's still a report coming out of trans people showing up in the emergency units and being turned away, or just being mistreated and mishandled by the medical community. But I think that there is a difference between the state of affairs right now in trans medicine, or how trans people's healthcare needs are met, and what it was like even 15, 20 years ago. So I think there has been improvement, and there's still a lot of room for change and growth.
Steph, down to our last minute here, we've gotten some history, we've gotten some sense of what's going on now. Do you have recommendations about some things that should happen still?
Yeah, so I think number one recommendation is, and I am fully aware that medical residency programs are already packed with lots of knowledge that residents need to acquire, but I think it begins there. It begins in medical training and education. And the more that we can familiarize all medical providers or all medical residents with the existence of trans people, their specific healthcare needs, and how their healthcare needs also overlap with cisgender people, it's like one place to begin addressing some of these broader problems, and not only the information they have, but also just these durable forms of inequalities that exist in medicine.
All right. So some ground to cover, obviously, in a lot of areas where there have been traditional biases, and trans mm-hmm. is part of that. Trans Medicine mm-hmm. is the book, The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender, the work of Steph M. Schuster, an assistant professor of sociology at Michigan State University. Steph, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, Jeffrey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
For us as well. Thank you. Take care.